Last time, 15 minutes ago. Is that visible? Okay. So last time, we saw quarks. And we defined a quark doublet to be up left and down left. This was a 2 plus 1 sixth under the standard model. There was UCR, which is a 1, comma minus 2 thirds under the standard model, and a DCR, which is a 1 and plus 1 third under the standard model. And we worked out the electroweak interactions of all of these, including the Higgs interactions. And the last thing we saw interactions with the Higgs. Was that we were able to write down something that we called H dagger Q D conjugate, right? So this gave us a down quark mass times D left DCR plus the Hermitian conjugate. And we have H Q with epsilon tensor times UCR, which gave us the mass of the up quark, times U left UCR plus its Hermitian conjugate. And this is the whole story for one generation. We also saw that in the interactions with the W, so the Lagrangian of quarks and W, the operator that we wrote down was G square root 2, U dagger left sigma mu W mu plus D left. And there was the opposite of this. This is the Hermitian conjugate, but I'll write it out in gory detail. W minus U left. And if this were the whole story, we would say, okay, then the W only interacts with an up quark and a down quark and the left-handed parts in two-component language. And this is proportional to G square root of 2. So I'm only going to say it's proportional for the time being because I want to write down Dirac spinners, and then we'll write down the Feynman rules in four-component language so that we never actually have to worry about scattering amplitudes and cross-sections where we have to remember the identities of the Pauli matrices in this particular language, where they're bars and so on. We'd much rather work with gamma matrices that you've already seen that everyone does computations with anyway. So we can define a Dirac spinner. So the four-component representation under the Lorentz group, I can say psi up is defined to be U left and U conjugate right, dagger, spinors. And I can say that down is down left DCR dagger. Okay. And this allows us to write down mass terms, so Dirac masses, of m up, psi bar up, psi up, and m down, psi down, psi down. Okay, so this is all true. So this is the full story for one generation. But there are many generations. There are three generations. So there are three generations. So keep that in mind. Let me just write down the Feynman rules in terms of the Dirac spinner. For W, I'll leave the Z as an exercise and a tutorial. Uh, derive the z. Derive the z interactions in a four-component Dirac spinners in the Dirac spinner language. So four-component Dirac spinors. Okay. But for the W, the Feynman rules should look something like this. So every time there's a down, there's an up. But the W only cares about the fact that there's a left-handed part of this Dirac spinner. The coefficient of the interaction is the SU2 coupling over square root 2. So we can say there's an up, a psi up, and a psi down, and a W that's going to be I square root 2. The I is just a definition of how do you do the Feynman rules. So you take the coefficient of the interaction in the Lagrangian, you put an I out front, and there's going to be a gamma mu times P left, which is the projector matrix acting on Dirac spinners. So I'll remind you that P left is 1/2 1 minus gamma 5, and it has the form 1, 2 by 2, 0, 0, 0. So it only takes the left-handed part of the Dirac spinner. So we could also rewrite the Lagrangian of the W and the quarks just as g square root 2, there's psi up bar times gamma mu W mu P left psi down. So I have to put a plus here, and there's going to be psi down bar gamma mu W minus P left psi up. Okay, so this is the charge current interaction in four components. And now we've actually gone through the full story. The Z thing is straightforward to generalize from the notes or from the video lectures. It's straightforward to just take the interactions for the Z that were in the two-component form and now just make the substitution. This is really the Dirac spinner. Insert the projectors as needed. And the story is very similar to what we did for leptons. In fact, it's almost identical, and there we did work out the Feynman rules for the Z also. So it's a good sanity check to just work it out on your own. But now let's add three generations. So far we've seen that the up and the down, so this is the first generation, and the masses of these things of the first generation are on the order of an MeV. Okay. There's also the charm. So this is the charm quark and the strange quark. So these make up the second generation. And their masses are on the order of 100 MeV, 100 MeV to GeV. And there's a third generation, which is the top and the bottom, or historically the facetious names were truth and beauty, which aren't really used anymore. So top and bottom, they make up the third generation. And here I'll distinguish between the top and the bottom, because really the third generation masses are wildly different. So the mass of the top is 175 GeV. This is the heaviest known particle that's ever been discovered. It's even heavier than the Higgs. And the mass of the bottom quark is about 4.2 GeV. Just for fun, so the mass of the Higgs is about 125 GeV. So the top wins even when it comes to the Higgs. And as you might suspect, so all the masses for the fermions are going to be proportional to their Yukawa couplings, how much they feel the interaction with the Higgs. And the top Yukawa coupling is going to have quite a large Yukawa coupling. All the other ones are going to be fairly small. The fact that the top and the bottom are in the same generation means that they'll actually live in the same SU2 doublet, which means that the Yukawa couplings do the maximum amount of violence to SU2 invariants. So this is, in some sense, the part of the theory that is most badly broken when the Higgs acquires a vacuum expectation value. Just for notation, we're going to do the same kind of thing in writing down the two-component stuff. The interactions that'll take you to, well, the definitions that'll take you from two-component to four-component language are going to be very similar. So now all I really want to do is put a flavor index. So now this is going to be a flavor index. And there's a bit of notation abuse because in the last lecture, which was some half hour ago, I used the I subscript on the doublet to be the SU2 index. But you run out of indices. If there's another index that you would prefer, you should speak up now. Pardon? What are those? Yeah, I can't help it. If I tried, it would be way worse, I assure you. So there's a flavor index. So from here on out, I'm not going to write down SU2 indices. For the rest of this lecture, all the Roman indices are going to, or the Latin, whichever ones they are, they're going to be the flavor indices. And so this is going to be up left, down left, and I'm going to put a flavor index on this. And I'll sometimes just say up left, down left, I, where this is going to be the first generation, second generation, or third generation. And these are all the up-type quarks. So these are all up-type. And these are all down-type. Okay. So this is the quark doublet. All the quark doublets have exactly the same quantum numbers. So Q sub I under G standard model transforms as a 2 comma plus 1/6 for all I. Well, I should say for all I. For all I, and there's going to be UCR I. So I just call it a U because it's an up type, but really there's going to be one of these for the charm and there's going to be another one for the top. And UCR is going to have the quantum numbers 1 minus 2/3, and DCRI is going to be 1 comma plus 1/3. Okay? Okay, so all A mu, Z mu interactions identical to first generation story. So there's nothing new that has to be added to this. The differences are not for the Higgs or the W. Okay. And so you might recall that in the story of leptons, we were able to diagonalize our mass term in such a way that didn't reintroduce the rotation matrices in any other part of the theory. And now that's not going to be true anymore. And you'll explore this in gory detail soon enough on your own. But consider the Higgs interaction. The Yukawa couplings. And we can write this down now as, say, Y up IJ. So this is now just a matrix in flavor space. And I apologize to those who spell flavor differently. For the up type, I don't put any index on the Higgs. There's only one Higgs doublet. There are theories of physics beyond the Standard Model where there are multiple Higgs doublets. The most famous one is supersymmetry, where you're required to have two Higgs doublets. And in supersymmetry, everything's done in two-component language because that's the most natural way to write down supersymmetric transformations. And so that's another motivation for using this notation, at least to set up the theory. So this is the SU2 invariant part of the doublet. I'm going to write down epsilon alpha beta just to remind us that these are now the SU2 indices. I'll suppress them from here on out. I just want to put them up on the board so that we remember what it was all about. So we can track two doublets with an epsilon tensor acting on the SU2 indices. I and J are the flavor indices. And the quark doublet has a flavor structure. So I can choose any one of those doublets for the first, second, or third generations. And then I can do the same thing for the UCR object. There's going to be just some flavor structure to this. And everything not forbidden is compulsory. And that's true in quantum field theory because if you don't write down some operator that you're allowed to write down, you'll generically reintroduce it in the theory. Unless there's a symmetry that tells you you really shouldn't be writing down some sort of operator, a good symmetry that isn't spoiled by quantum corrections, then it'll be reintroduced and you should have included it in the first place. So you keep it in mind. So we're allowed to write down things that mix up the different flavor, well, the different generations. So we could have written down, for example, y up times, for the flavor indices, I can write down top and strange. So this is, the top is the third generation, the strange is the second generation, and that would have given me, after expanding about the minimum, that gives me v over square root of 2 in place of the Higgs. That'll give me top left for the part of the doublet from the third generation. So I is just telling us that it's the top. And it would give me strange, right? Ah, crap. Strange conjugate right, strange. Okay, so this would give me an off-diagonal mass term. And we don't like to play with those, so why did I even bother telling you what the masses of these things were if they can just mix with each other? Well, we can do the same thing that we did last time. So rotate. So in flavor space, so I can send Q I into some matrix. Well, I should pause. Once the Higgs is expanded around its minimum, now we should really think about the left and the right-handed thing as the important objects. And organizing them in Dirac spinners is the right way to think about it. Now the doublet isn't really a useful way to think about things because the doublet's nice because it tells you how things transform when SU2 is an exact symmetry of the theory before spontaneous symmetry breaking. But after you've expanded about the Higgs minimum, then SU2 is no longer manifest in the vacuum, and so Q is not the right way to think about things. And now we can just think of the left and the right-handed parts as or the up and the down as separate things. The things that were united in the doublet are now just totally different objects. So I can say that my UI left is going to go into some matrix IJ for U left. This is part of the matrix, isn't a name, unfortunately. U left J. So this is just some flavor transformation where I'm just trying to diagonalize this matrix. And I can say that U right conjugate J is going to go to U conjugate right JL times UCRL. So these are just flavor indices. Those are the only ones I'm writing down. And so what's going to happen? I can do the same thing for the down type quarks, but let's see it first over here. So now UL and UCR IJ JL are chosen to diagonalize. To diagonalize y up, ij. Okay, so now we can talk about we can talk about up and up type Yukawa couplings. So now this is just going to be y up, y charm, and y top in flavor space. Okay. But we pay a price. So first we want to do the same thing for down quarks. For Higgs down interactions. So we would start with YD IJ. And now there would be H dagger Q I and D C R J. So now you could have also had a mixed mass term, but now you diagonalize. So now we act with matrices U D left and U D right conjugate to get to make this a diagonal. So it'd be diagonal y down, y strange, and y bottom. Okay. So we've diagonalized the mass term, and everything's totally fine from the standpoint of writing down Yukawa couplings. This is a choice of basis that we're allowed to make. That's not good. For Z and photon interactions, for couplings, the U's disappear. So they disappear because all of those interactions are of the form, say, they're of the form, say, U left dagger, sigma mu, Z mu, U left. So that's manifestly going to be invariant under flavor transformations or flavor rotations. If, because we're going to take U to be unitary. But the W's might be a problem. Because U left is not the same as U D left. So the matrix that took this operator for the up type quarks and this operator for the down type quarks and made them separately diagonal was different. So the one acting on the left-handed parts that will show up in the W interaction is just different because we didn't know what these things were a priori. And so we might get something along the lines of a matrix times U left dagger W mu, I should have written the sigma mu W mu down left. And actually I'll just call this V. This is just some matrix. That owes its origin to the fact that we changed bases. So we started off with a theory that had a diagonal interaction in the sense that the first generation up and down quarks coupled to the W and then there were no crossings between generations. Then the second generation coupled separately and the third one so on. And that was our initial choice of basis. But then the Higgs spoiled everything by giving these things masses in a way that in principle could have been completely generic. And this is some matrix, but I shouldn't be so glib because it's not just any matrix, it's the CKM matrix. For Kabibo, I probably misspelled that, so sorry. Kabibo, Kobayashi, and Masakawa. Too many quotations. So Kabibo, Kobayashi, Masakawa Matrix, and along with Hideki Yukawa, Kobayashi and Masakawa won the Nobel Prize in 1979 for this matrix. Sometimes it's just called the KM matrix. That's not right. So Kabibo in the 1960s and early 70s did it for the case of two generations. So when it was only known that you had up, down, charm, and strange. And that matrix was just a 2x2. Kobayashi and Masakawa generalized it to be a 3x3 matrix with profound implications. So they generalized. It might be a silly reason to get a Nobel Prize, and in truth, Kabibo probably deserved it too. But, oh crap, it's not 79, it's like 2009. Okay, good. So this had profound implications for nature, for the baryon asymmetry of the universe, for cosmology, for LHC physics, for everything. So this is an important thing that you'll learn more about. For now, I'm just going to say that it's some matrix in flavor space. So I'm going to add I and J. So Vij, Vckm, Ij mixes flavor in W interactions. Now, in W interactions with quarks, and so the Feynman rules, crap. For the W now just have to be modified slightly. So the Feynman rules, we're going to have a psi-op, so this is a Dirac, in Dirac language, in the usual sense, in exactly the way that we've been writing Dirac matrices all along. I'll rewrite it here just for clarity. But there's a psi-d, and now I'm going to put a flavor index here because this matrix can change flavor indices. W mu, and this interaction is going to be Ig square root of 2 Vij. This is just the usual I square root of minus 1. This is the flavor index of the CKM matrix. There's going to be a gamma mu and a P left to remind us that it only talks to the left-handed parts of Dirac spinners. And recall that psi u is u left, U conjugate right, and psi down is U down up, D left, D conjugate right, and now these things will carry generation indices. So there's going to be I and I. Okay. So that's the last Feynman rule that we have to account for in the electroweak theory. I'm probably not going to get to do QCD, so I'll just leave that for Stefania next week. Sorry, Stefania. Because I really just want to talk about what's so special about this. Well, not the most special thing, but I guess a pretty zeroth order fundamental fact about the universe is that only E, U, and D are stable. Well, okay, fine, and the photon's stable too. And A, mu, okay? So these are the only stable particles as far as we know. We know there's dark matter in the universe, so maybe that's stable. We don't know. It's possible to have a theory where it's not stable, but just lives for billions of years. But E up and down are stable. And protons are just bound states of two up quarks and one down quark. So the charge of a proton is the electric charges of these things. So this is going to be plus 2/3 minus 1/3, and this is plus 1. That's the charge of a proton. Good. And this is actually the motivation for choosing this weird structure. That if we really had to do the story all over again and pick conventions, what we would have done is defined minus 1/3 to be the fundamental charge. That would have been what we now call E. And then the other things would have had charges 2 and 3. But we're stuck with it because the electron was discovered first. It was given charge of 1, which means that the substructure of the proton just had to be downgraded. But secretly, this was the motivation for giving the weird hypercharge assignments, because any candidate theory of the weak interactions would have had to reproduce what we already know and love about nature. And at the time that these things were first proposed in the early 60s, the proton was already known, obviously, and so was the neutron. So the neutron, d and u. So the q of the neutron is minus 1/3, and plus 2/3, which is 0. Okay? So these are the only, the neutron is not stable. Not stable outside of nuclei. And it's only stable inside of nuclei because the proton-neutron mass difference is so small that the binding effect of being inside of a nucleus is just enough to change its mass inside of a bound state, enough to the point where the decay is no longer kinematically allowed. But a free neutron lives for about 800 seconds. And something similar happens in neutron stars, but I won't go into that. But only these are the stable particles, and protons are also stable because of their because they're lighter than neutrons. But what about everything else? How does everything else decay? So what about the others? It turns out all decays are through W interactions. W, so charged current, so absolutely every single decay that's ever been observed at tree level is a charged current interaction. There are higher loop effects that involve neutral current interactions. We're not going to get into those, at least not for now. But those loop effects secretly involve W's living virtually inside of loops of Feynman diagrams, because absolutely the only thing in the standard model that changes flavor is the CKM matrix. Okay. But there's a little subtlety. The subtlety is that most of the decays are three-body. So the three body in the sense that you might start off with, let's say, a strange quark. A strange quark can decay into a charm quark, and it can't actually emit a W. So let's say this is the decaying particle. And time is going in that direction. So the strange quark could, in principle, decay, but it's not massive enough. So questions? No? All right. So there's a decaying particle. It's strange. But it would have to decay by emitting other particles. So the W would have to be virtual. And these are hard to compute, and they're annoying because they're three-body phase spaces in the final state. This could give you, say, a neutrino and an electron. So there's a nu e and an electron in the final state. This is annoying. And the reason is that MW is just much, much bigger than the masses of most quarks. Most quarks and all leptons. But there's one exception to this, and it's the top quark. So the top is the only exception. And the top is also nice because every time that we talk about quarks, what we secretly mean is that quarks are good degrees of freedom. For processes where the energy is above lambda QCD, which is another parameter of the theory, which we don't have the tools to talk about coherently yet, 200 MeV. Because usually, for processes that are lower than this, the running of the strong coupling constant means that everything's going to be confined in these bound states. And typically, this confinement happens before decay. Just the characteristic time scale of forming a bound state. So you smash two protons together, you produce, say, a strange quark as one of your final state objects, and then that strange quark lives for a little while and then it decays. But quantum mechanically, the probability of forming a bound state, given the strength of the QCD interaction, it's just so much stronger that it happens so much faster that this thing will form some sort of meson. It'll form a proton, or well, it won't form a proton because of the flavor structure, but it'll form some sort of composite object, and that composite object will decay, and that's a much more involved thing to calculate. But the top quark's different because its mass is so large that it actually happened, it decays before it hadronizes. So the only exception is the top quark, which decays first because its mass is so huge. Okay. So top decay. So it's the one friendly example among the quarks where we can sensibly talk about the top quark as a fundamental degree of freedom, because its decay will happen while it still knows of itself as a fundamental degree of freedom. And it also has a bonus, which is VCKM for off-diagonal diagonal top interactions is tiny. So the top will almost never change flavor structure. Its branching ratio is almost 100% into B and W, just like that. Now we can compute the amplitude for this process. So this is in the four-component language, but we have to remember that there's a projector acting on this because the W only knows about the left-handed part of what started life here. Just to address a subtlety, every top has a certain kind of color because it's a QCD-charged object. There are red tops, there are blue tops, and there are green tops, if those are the ways you want to think about the three kinds of objects that live in a fundamental representation of SU3. We don't have to worry about that right now because I'm just going to pick a specific kind. So I'm picking a specific color of top. This is the decay amplitude for a red top, say. And I'm free in principle. If nature were slightly different and we had smaller instruments that operated on shorter timescales, we could prepare states of, you know, of individual color, but we can't. But nature can do that on very short timescales. So the decay amplitude for the top going into WB, because it's 175 GeV. This is about 4.2 GeV. And this is about 80 GeV. So this is kinematically allowed. So the decay amplitude is just going to go like 1 over G, square root of 2. It's going to have a spinner, a Dirac spinner in the final state. So we remember our Feynman rules for this. So now I'm just going to write U of PB, where this is the momentum of the B, this is the incoming momentum of the top, and this is the outgoing momentum of the W. So, and for my own benefit, I'm just going to say that PW mu, just four vector, is going to be defined to be Q mu. So I just want to, this is just a kinematic thing. The U is just the Dirac's Dirac-Feynman rule. Not to be confused, so it's not the up quark. So this is just the scattering amplitude of a Dirac spinner of any kind. So this is the external leg for the B. Then I hit a vertex, so the vertex is going to be gamma mu times P sub L. There's going to be another spinner for P top, and there's going to be an epsilon mu, which is the polarization of the W. The polarization tensor of the W boson. So the polarization tensor is a little different than it would be for, say, QED. For massless spin one, there's a completeness relation. There's a completeness relation that tells us that if we sum over the spins of two tensors in the following way, so there's some epsilon mu of S and some epsilon nu with spin polarization R. So these are just the polarizations. There are only two polarizations for a massless spin one particle, and that this thing can be replaced with minus G mu nu for photons, say, because the photon's massless. Mm-hmm. Now, I write the arrow instead of an equality because there are other things. This expression depends on your choice of gauge to some extent, but the other things, once you put them in there, are guaranteed to vanish by Ward identities and by gauge invariance more generally. So this is what and I should put there's technically a star on one of these. But it doesn't really matter because I could always choose polarization basis for both of these are real. But formally speaking, the relation's only true if one of them is conjugated. For a massive spin one, there would be a slightly different relationship. Epsilon mu s. Epsilon nu r. I'll say the same thing. So it'll go into minus g mu nu. It can always be replaced after you square a Feynman amplitude with, say, q mu q nu over the mass of the particle, mass of the spin one gauge boson. So this is the one other thing that we need, and I want to put a box around it because it's handy and it comes up in calculations a lot. So we actually don't have all that much time, but I just want to continue this very quickly. So the top decays into a W. The amplitude is IG square root of 2. This is just the spinner from the Feynman rule, whose argument is the momentum of the B. There's gamma mu, epsilon mu for the W. This is just the polarization tensor. And we recall the slash notation. Whenever you contract Dirac matrices into four vectors, and this is properly just a four vector, we can call this slash. So gamma mu is epsilon slash. This is Feynman slash notation. And there's a projector, P left, U, P top. And we demand that P B mu plus P top mu plus P W mu is P top mu just by energy and momentum conservation. And so when we square this, the amplitude squared shouldn't stand in the way of everybody seeing this, is going to go like g squared over 2. It's going to be u bar p sub b, the polarization of the w slashed, there's a p left, u p top, and there's a star on that, u bar p b, same thing, but no star. Okay, so this is the amplitude, and now we want to sum over polarizations. Polarizations and spins. Recall that for Dirac spinners, there's a completeness relation. And I apologize for moving in this direction. It just seemed like the most convenient thing to do at the time, but there are only a few minutes left, so I'll just breeze through this. But that for, if you sum over the fermion spins of the object that we can call UP bar, so the bar goes on the other one, but it's the same one, the same kind of spinner, that this is, should be familiar from QED, is just P slash times the plus. And there's a slightly different convention if one of these things is a V instead of a U, if it's conjugated in the usual QED sense. So I'm not going to work out the full details of this, but I just want to remind us that when we do a spin, when we sum over the polarizations, that's going to give us the new completeness relation, because when we square this amplitude, there's going to be an epsilon tensor and another epsilon tensor. So that summing over those polarizations is really just going to give us a g mu nu that we can contract with, and other stuff that goes along for the new completeness relation for a massive spin one particle. And just recall that when you sum over fermion spins, you have to do a trace. Trace over spinor indices. So this is the procedure. So you sum the polarization spins. So you use the massive spin one convention for the polarization tensor. And there's a trace over these things. So I can rewrite this as g squared over 2. U bar PB epsilon slash P left UP top dagger. This is just a number. And I can replace this with a dagger, but I can use matrix identities that are friendlier when I dagger them and act on the components of these things that multiply into each other to return a scalar. U of PB epsilon slash P left U of P top, and we're over time, so next time I'll just make a few more comments about this kind of calculation. But this, in principle, is identical to calculations that you've seen in QED. The only subtlety is that now there's also a 1/2, 1 minus gamma 5. And so working through this amplitude, integrating over the phase space can give you the decay width of a particle, i.e. its decay rate. But we'll get to that next time. So just consult appendix in Peskin and Schroeder. That deals with the decays of particles once you know what their amplitude squareds are. After you've used all the tricks and have now just gotten it into some sort of function of momenta, after all the spinner indices have been traced over. So I'll stop there. I know it's not complete, but it's just a taste of what's to come. So are there any more questions? No? Okay.